Notebooks and news beats, hear that piano rail. Take down the facts, Ace, write up the tale. Deadlines and dreamers, someday we'll meet, if only they turn left on Bird Street. Don't be a fool, Ace. Trust nothing they say. Follow the money, make them all pay. Under a headline, over a beer, truth plainly told is what they most fear. Deadlines and dreamers, someday we'll meet down at the dark end of Bird Street.
Get ready, my radio partner,
Tom Nato.
Welcome to Left Turn on Bird Street. We're broadcasting from our flagship station, KRBS 107.1 FM, on your low-power radio dial. KRBS is located in Oroville, California, the city of gold in the Golden State. We're also web-stream live on the internet. Go to the KRBS website, which you can follow find on Google by typing in KRBS, and follow the simple clicking instructions. Then, too, you can hear this show and some of our past Left Turn on Bird Street episodes by going to our blog, which is conveniently located on the internets at www.ltobs.blogspot.com and click on our library index of programs. So, Tom, what are we going to talk about today?
Well, before we have some fun, we're going to be talking about what else? Katrina.
Katrina, of course. You know, that's the big topic of the it's going to be the big topic of the year, along with the situation in Iraq. But I think, didn't you say you had a few other things you wanted to talk about before we got to?
Oh, yeah. But before we the Katrina thing,
yes.
I just want to mention that that's getting boring and depressing and scary.
Yes,
so
it
we'll
is.
We'll save that for the last so we can leave you in a funk when we go.
Right.
I did want to point out that we're creeping up on our second anniversary.
A second anniversary of Left Turn on Bird Street?
Right. Our Great. First blog was in September 2003, and our first Left Turn on Bird Street broadcast was here on KRBS in October 2003.
October 2003. I think it was around the 13th. I wonder if the 13th is a Friday this year. I had to look at a calendar.
Oh, that would be good.
No, it can't be because, you know, we're heard every other Monday, so that was 2 years ago. We had a leap year in there. So,
could be.
Something like that. It would be that would be appropriate though if it was Friday the 13th in October, right?
Right.
Halloween
I mean, think of it,
season.
Think of it. In all that time, I believe I've missed only one show.
You've been much, and you know what, Tom? And you were hospitalized at that time. You had a legitimate excuse. Me, on the other hand, I've missed about. I can count them on one hand, but I don't think I've gone to the second
two.
Hand
I
yet.
I think you did two.
No, well, I was on vacation a couple times. I went to Michigan. Remember you interviewed me when I had the brake problems up in Michigan?
Oh, that's right. That was a lot of fun.
I actually
the traffic
found
noise
honest,
in the background.
I actually found an honest mechanic in Michigan, which is not unusual. But, I called in from a side street just before we had a couple Coney Island hot dogs.
Anyway, we ought to have a party, Dan, because this may be the longest I've ever held a job without being fired at least once. If you can call a task you're not getting paid for a job.
That's true. But, hey, we view this as our contribution to mankind and humanity and society.
Not to mention low-power radio.
That's right, low-power radio here on KRBS in Oroville, California.
And there's another anniversary this year.
What's that?
We shouldn't let this slip by before the year ends. 2005 marks the semi-official 50th anniversary of rock and roll.
Right on.
I say semi-official because, like anything else, there is some dispute over what exactly was the first rock and roll song.
What was the first rock and roll song?
Well, many think that Rock Around the Clock by Bill Haley and the Comets, 1955, was the first ever rock and roll song. That's the one I plump for.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
However, some rock and roll historians contend Rocket 88, credited to Jackie Brinson, whoever that is, but written by Ike Turner.
Of Ike and Tina Turner.
Right. And they made a movie out of
that. Yes, they did.
And
it wasn't very flattering to Ike either.
No, but I liked it. It was a good movie.
Yeah.
And that was released in 1951. They say that may have been the first one. Rocket 88 is the first song to gather together most of the basic elements of early rock and roll into one place. Still, other songs have been dubbed by some rock historians as earlier examples of R&R. Haley had Shake, Rattle, and Roll previously. Yeah. Arthur Crudup, Winoni Harris, and Big Joe Turner. I wonder if they're in relation.
I don't know.
Put out songs going back into the late 1940s that verged on true rock and roll. For these reasons, some say there was no definite first rock and roll song. But for all practical purposes, the only song that is internationally accepted as the one that brought the big beat in was Rock Around the Clock.
By Bill Haley and the Comets. And he was from Philadelphia, was he not?
I don't know.
I think he was. I heard the report on it recently.
I do know that DJ Alan Freed was from Cleveland. He was the one who's credited with being the man to put the term rock and roll in general circulation.
And that's why Cleveland got the Rock and Roll Museum, for no other reason, because the term was coined in Cleveland by a disc jockey, no less.
The song was so big, they made a movie out of it with Haley and Freed in it. And I saw it at the Capitol Theater in Portland, Maine.
Wait, did you see it when the first release, Tom?
Exactly, exactly. That's how old I am. Think of it, Dan. I'm even older than rock and roll.
Do you think I think you're older than dirt, Tom.
Well, it's all rock and roll to me.
Right. Well, it's interesting how rock has changed over the years. It used to be, I guess today's version would be hip-hop, and even hip-hop has gone very commercial. Well, in the sense that it's a rebellion against parents and the norms of the time. Rock and roll has become so mainstream, it's incredible. You watch TV and you see the Rolling Stones being sponsored by AmeriQuest. That's who's sponsoring their concert, the Rolling Stones.
And AmeriQuest
is a really, really crooked mortgage company. I guess that's the best way to describe them. Their
opinions stated here are not the responsibility of KRBS Radio or any of its backers.
That's true. Good thing you mentioned that. But no, AmeriQuest is a mortgage company that has used questionable tactics in getting loans and basically harassing people to have loans with them. And yet they're sponsoring a rock and roll concert. And the rock and rollers, who were supposed to be the rebels, now have gone so mainstream that it's no longer has the edge that it once did.
I don't want to get off the topic here, but how could you sell a 30-year mortgage in which you don't start accrue any kind of ownership till the 30 years have elapsed as anything but crooked?
Right. Well, you're listening to Left Turn on Bird Street. We're heard every other Monday on KRBS. And like we said a few minutes ago, take a look at our blog. It's on the internets. It's not the internet. You know, there's two of them, as we've like to remind our listeners. At www.ltobs.blogspot.com.
Well, you know, the
Tom, what is it you want to talk about now?
Well, before we actually get into the fully into the Katrina devastation and problem, I want to point out that it turns out that low power radio is performing an important service for
absolutely.
That. There's a story here that I picked up from mediachannel.org. Name is printed out here as Juby Shriver Jr.
Juby?
Well, I think what they mean is Jude with Jude. A D, not J-U-B-E. But if that's how he spells his name, that's how he does it. This comes out of the L.A. Times.
Right.
It says that federal regulators have authorized an unusual radio station to serve the estimated 10,000 evacuees living in the Houston Astrodome. Part of an effort to fill the information void left by Hurricane Katrina.
Katrina.
Yeah, because they got Katrines here. Katrines. So if they can spell Katrina wrong, then they can also spell Juby
wrong.
Disruption of communication services along the Gulf Coast. The Federal Communications Commission over the weekend granted Houston relief volunteers and media organizers permission to build a 30-watt radio station inside the Astrodome.
Wow.
Now, we're only 100 watts
right
at KRBS, so that sounds like a just about cover that stadium. Government and industry officials said it was the first time they could recall that a domestic radio station had been set up primarily to keep victims of a U.S. disaster informed. We'll skip down a little bit here. The station is the brainchild of James Ellinger, who heads Austin Airwaves, Inc., a nonprofit community radio group in Austin, Texas, at 95.3 FM. It will air news about hurricane recovery efforts at the Gulf Coast, as well as an information about jobs and enrolling children in school. The signal is expected to travel 3 to 5 miles from the Astrodome.
And, that's pretty good range.
The station was scheduled to go on the air today, which this was written so that it would have come out on the 8th of September, so it's about 2 days ago. But,
big but here.
Astrodome officials pressured station organizers Wednesday to hold off until they could secure enough portable radios with earphones so that the people could listen to the station without disturbing others who might be resting. Now, these are the same ones who could find no food, no water. Oh, no, no, that's right. The Superdome over
right.
in
Oregon. But in the convention center.
Anyway, so.
Well, that's good. That's good to hear that FEMA's actually, or was it FEMA? Actually, it's an individual. Oh, how silly of me to say that. You know, that it looks like the individuals and the Canadian Mounties and the Mexican Army are doing more than FEMA. But we'll get to that.
There's one other interesting fact in this. On Wednesday, Kenneth P. Morgan, an FCC official who directs the agency's domestic security efforts. Everything's got domestic security
now.
Yeah,
I know it.
They told members of the House Energy and Commerce Committee that Katrina knocked out more than 3 million phone lines in Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama and silenced an estimated 50 to 100 radio and television stations.
Wow.
No television. I mean, all those soap operas, they're not going to be able to keep up. When it comes back on the air, they're going to go back and replay the things. We're going to catch up on little installments.
Oh, golly. Just as a side note, that reminds me of a story about my dear departed grandmother. We took her up north in northern Michigan 1 year, and she was in a state of panic because she was going to miss, I can't remember, it's still on. This was back in the 60s. I think it was our Days of Our Lives or something like that. She was going to miss 2 or 3 episodes. And you'd go visit grandma on Christmas, and she didn't miss that program. As the World Turns, Days of Our Lives, one of those really, really old ones. Anyhow, that's a whole other story.
Sure. But everything is another story.
Yeah.
Anyway, now let's get into the whole Katrina thing. But I want to introduce this with my favorite quote from the whole thing. And it comes via Billman, or the Whiskey Bar.
Oh, yeah, Whiskey
right?
Bar.
Yeah, right. He says he's
on the internet.
Right. This is what he's saying. His headline was, "A Better Class of Idiots." "Bureaucracy has murdered people in the greater New Orleans area," Aaron Broussard, president of Jefferson Parish, said on CBS Early Show. Now, Broussard is the guy who dramatically broke down
the
crimes after giving a really good summation of what was wrong, what was going wrong. Anyway, he says, "So I'm asking Congress, please investigate this now. Take whatever idiot they have at the top of whatever agency and give me a better idiot. Give me a caring idiot. Give me a sensitive idiot. Just don't give me the same idiot." Clearly, this man is a man with realistic expectations, says Billman. Although whether they're realistic enough remains to be seen. Update, 12:20 p.m. Eastern Time. "It looks like Mr. Broussard may need to ratchet down his expectations some more. From Gallup, we get few Americans feel that any top official in the agencies responsible for handling emergencies should be dismissed from office. Just 29% say someone should be fired, while 63% disagree. Accountability," says Billman, "it seems, isn't in the American lexicon anymore."
Well, you know, Bush has really driven that away. You know, and that brings up something else. About accountability, just as a side note, as many of the things are I mentioned on this program, you know, aren't the Republicans and the conservatives who have really brought that into our daily vocabulary, personal responsibility, accountability.
But not accountability. Responsibility, yeah, you could assign. Accountability,
right,
you can't.
Right. Yeah. The accountability is the other thing. And yet, nobody in the Bush administration is going to really ultimately be held accountable for this or 9/11 or the debacle we're facing in Iraq. There is no accountability. There is no personal responsibility taken. So just keep that in mind as we go through this discussion about Hurricane Katrina. You know, and this brings up something that you called me this morning on the cell phone to kind of rub my nose in, although I got a little bit of a comeback.
No, I'm not the one to say. Yeah.
Tom and I have had a ongoing, I guess you'd call it a gentleman's bet sort of thing, on whether Brown would be fired or not. Embattled FEMA chief Michael Brown, that is. Or, hey, Brownie, you're doing a heck of a job there, man. Hey, Brownie, you're doing a heck of a job, as George W. Bush would say.
And how would he know what a job was anyway?
Right. Well, as everybody probably knows by now, I think Michael Brown's before we get to that, Tom and I had a bet. I didn't think that Brown would be fired. Tom said, oh, this guy's out of there because he's going to be a liability. He's not going to raise money.
Now, let's get this right off. In a conversation on the phone, I said, well, that guy's gone. And he said, oh, no. They're too impervious to that sort of thing. They wouldn't really fire him. I said, nah, this guy is screwed up too bad, and he's too far down the food chain to keep his job. And guess what? Dan, you can read it.
But he wasn't totally fired. He hasn't been totally fired yet. Okay, according to this, this report, embattled FEMA chief removed from hurricane relief efforts. Michael Brown, the embattled head of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, was removed today from a direct role, and that was a couple days ago, in running the relief and recovery efforts in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. Michael Chertoff, Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, announced. Chertoff made the announcement at a brief, hastily announced press conference in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, with Brown at his side. He would not let Brown respond to questions. You've been a bad little boy.
Every time he opens his mouth, it makes things worse.
Oh, yeah, that guy is an idiot. You got something else there, Tom?
Yeah, it's on the same topic. Yeah. But I want to point out, this is from the Times-Picayune, but
yes,
it's an AP story, and it Lara Jakes Jordan wrote this, and it says, Brown was relieved of his on-site command Friday, so they're moving him down.
Right.
Whereas just get out of town, go back to Washington, you have the only thing to do
Take
here.
Take up some space in some office.
Asked if he was being made a scapegoat for a federal relief effort that has drawn widespread and sharp criticism, Brown told the Associated Press after a long pause. By the press, yes. By the president, no.
Yeah, right.
Anyway, less than an hour before Brown's removal came to light, White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan said Brown had not resigned and the president had not asked for his resignation.
See, I told you.
But Republican Senator Trent Lott, whose Pensacola, Mississippi home was destroyed in the storm, said he too had concluded that FEMA was overwhelmed, undermanned, and not capable of doing the job under Brown's leadership. Michael Brown has been acting like a private instead of a general.
Yeah, that's
Lott
right.
Said. Anyway, it goes on to say.
Well, Lott would only say that. The only reason he's saying that, if he was some northern or western conservative senator, the only reason he's saying that is because he actually got his house that he and President Bush like to sit on and drink iced tea, by the way, destroyed. Had he been from some other state, he'd say, nah, tough luck, they deserve it. But you know what? It actually touched him. That's the only reason he said that. But go ahead, Tom.
Well, now, is this not a bureaucrat's
double
response?
Talk.
In a telephone interview with AP, Brown said he was anxious to get back to D.C. to correct all the inaccuracies and lies that are being
right.
said. Asked if the move was a demotion. No. Still the director of FEMA. He said Chertoff made the decision to move him out of Louisiana. It was not his own decision. I'm going to go home and walk my dog and hug my wife. And maybe get a good Mexican meal and a stiff margarita and a full night's sleep. Now, he could stay there in Louisiana and get good French food.
I feel so sorry for him.
This story is not about me. Oh, yes, it is, fella.
This guy is clueless.
This story is about the worst disaster of the history of our country. That stretched every government to its limit. I mean, state, local, and federal by that. And now we have to help these victims. Anyway, so it goes on to say that, turns out that he was fibbing on his resume.
Right. Yeah. I was just going to get to that. That's amazing. Well, first of all, let's tell him about what were his qualifications prior to becoming the head of FEMA? Well, first of all, I guess you can sum it up in a two-word phrase. He was a political hack.
Well, I think in up his qualifications in one word. None.
I was going to say zero.
Yeah, right.
I was going to do a little telepathy here, Tom. Zero. Okay, so, this is a story. Let's see. It looks like was this from the Times-Picayune or Time Magazine?
Yes,
okay.
The LA Times quoting News Time Magazine, okay. And another publication.
Well, before we get into this, we should point out that Brown, before he became a member of the Bush administration, was the head of a horse trade association. So
Arabian
let's see,
horse.
Tom, you and I have been reporters. We might as well. Hell, we probably better qualified than this guy. I mean, we've actually reported on accidents and disasters, and we've seen it firsthand. This guy has never seen it. So that's the first item with Brownie. Hey, Brownie, you're doing a heck of a job there. The other thing is, according to Time Magazine, and I got the story right here too, Tom, if you want to take a look
at it.
There's
one quote in there that points out that he was the director of the Arabian Horse Trading Association, what it's called here. But anyway, he was there for 10 years, but neglected to mention that in his resume when he's looking for the job. But he did inflate his positions with other firms or other organizations.
Right.
And you have some of those there.
Right, I do. And before that, he was actually fired. He was fired from the Arabian Horse Association. So this guy was fired. And according to Time Magazine, in a story titled, "How Reliable is Brown's Resume? A Time Investigation Reveals Discrepancy in the FEMA Chief's Official Biographies." And let me just read a little bit from the story from Time Magazine. Before joining FEMA, only previous stint in emergency management, according to his bio posted on FEMA's website, was, quote, "serving as an assistant city manager with emergency services oversight." The White House press release from 2001 stated that Brown worked for the city of Edmond, Oklahoma from 1975 to 1978, quote, "overseeing the emergency services division." In fact, according to Claudia Deakins, head of public relations for the city of Edmond, Brown was an assistant to the city manager from 1987 to 1980. Let's stop here. From 85 to 78, okay, so not a manager himself and had no authority over other employees.
The man who was the mayor of Edmond at the time says, Randall Shadid, told AP on Friday that Brown had been an assistant to the city manager, never assistant city manager. Now, if you ever covered city government,
right.
You know the difference between that.
Right.
You know, it's more like an intern.
Right. Well, here's the quote. Quote, "the assistant is more like an intern."
Shadid now says, "I think there's a difference between the two positions. I would think that is a discrepancy."
Well, let me read this. This is great. Department heads did not report to him. Brown did a good job at his humble position, however, according to his boss. Quote, "yes, Mike Brown worked for me. He was an administrative assistant. He was a student at Central State University," recalls former city manager Bill Dasher. "Mike used to handle a lot of details. Every now and again, I'd ask him to write a speech. He was very loyal." Now, this is great. This is the best part. "He was always on time. He always had on a suit and a starched white shirt." We shouldn't be laughing about this, but it's comical.
What was that quote from Death of the Salesman? "Shine in your shoes."
That's right.
You can go anyplace.
He had a starched white shirt. I mean, so, okay, this guy is a political hack. He is in a position that in the Clinton administration was a cabinet-level position. Actually, FEMA was a cabinet-level position. He gets this job because he was a college. Now, this going further in the timeline, he gets this job at FEMA in the new Bush administration because he was college roommates. His college roommate was the first head of FEMA. So it was this Joseph Albaugh, I think, if I'm not mistaken his name.
Now, well, not only that, but he raised money.
Right, he raised money.
He was good at raising money. Well, that's your entree into politics. If you can raise money, you can get any job you want to in politics. I know because I've done that.
Right. You know, and this brought back a earlier episode of Left Turn on Bird Street about a year ago or so. I remember we were talking about the CPA when it was in existence, the Coalitional Provisional Authority, I believe it was called, before the Iraqi elections, the government were set up. And you had, Tom, you had found a story from The Guardian or some an English newspaper, definitely wasn't an American news source, that basically said all the political appointees running things over in Iraq were just political hacks, contributors, sons and daughters of rich contributors who had no relevant experience, work experience to start with, because a lot of these kids were in their early and mid 20s
on their semester break from law school.
Right, they're interning, I guess, setting up a new government. And this really isn't surprising, but what really surprises me about this more than anything else is in the post 9/11 world, where Bush and all the neocons want to investigate every iota of every person's life, they're exempt from it. You would have thought that this guy would have been vetted to look at his biography. He's a cabinet. Yeah, I mean, really, if you think about it, during the Clinton administration, this was a cabinet level position. This guy,
I'm sure they did vet him and found out that he raised money. That's the important thing,
right? But where was the mainstream press on this? Where, you know, how come they didn't look into this guy? You know, his background. I mean, you or I could go up there and say, you know, we're the editor of the New York Times, and if we contributed enough money, they would say, sure. And then the mainstream media would probably say, well, sure, they're not going to look into it. So it's a failure on many different levels, most of all for the people of New Orleans and the Gulf Coast.
Part of this, I was looking for a quote earlier, and I couldn't find it. Well, I found it again. And in Chertoff, in describing the non-firing of Brown, mentioned that this is one of the devices. You never really fired. You just moved another, even more responsible
right.
position that you don't do anything in.
I think it's called the Peter Principle,
right.
Isn't it?
Chertoff said the department was preparing to move from immediate emergency response to its next phase and needed a, get this, this is the one that we'd be talking about for, a seamless interaction with military forces. This is where we're having U.S. forces introduced to the United States to
right.
police the American people and with what, Blackwater?
Right,
people
Blackwater's
doing this.
In there now.
This,
yeah.
this is all part of a steady takeover of the American system by a cabal of military-oriented people. The Pentagon, we've said it before, I said it before, is that 2008, we don't need to worry about election. It'll either be so rigged
right.
or so unnecessary because generals in the Pentagon are running everything.
You know, Tom, I hate to do this again. Just another side note. You know, when you said the rigged election, it made me think of something. Last night, my wife picked up a couple of newspapers. They're Filipino newspapers. And the headline in both of them are about protests in the Philippines to remove Gloria Arroyo from office. And I credit the Filipino people. They're out in the street protesting there. You know what Arroyo's alleged to have perpetrated about a year ago? It's alleged now, and it's come up in the last 2 or 3 months, that she rigged the elections. So unlike
no.
Americans, Filipino people are taking to the streets, and they're protesting. They even got Cory Aquino, who was the first president after Marcos, to participate in this, and I'm sure she has her political motivations.
That might be because under previous prime ministers or presidents, they had no elections. When they finally
yeah, right.
got them, they valued them.
Exactly, exactly. Tom, great telepathy there, because that was exactly my point, is they value it. And so the Filipino people have taken to the streets in protests because they feel that the election was rigged and she shouldn't be in office. Where are Americans during all this time? Why are not people, you know, much less in 2000, in 2004, and today? How come the average American, and we don't have to discuss this, is just something to think about, how come we do not value this as much as And I think you answered the question for me, but this is something for our listeners to ponder. How come we do not value our freedoms, value a truly democratic society?
Because we view democracy as we do the electricity. We're surprised when it goes off.
Yeah, right.
We don't know. What happened? What happened?
Right.
You know, I actually saved an article I was going to deal with later on. It's a article from consortiumnews.com. Robert mm-hmm. Perry, an award-winning reporter for many years. He's
right.
one of the guys that broke the Iraq, the Iran-Contra
oh, right.
story for New York Times and other papers.
Right.
And he goes into this question about why aren't we doing something about it? And, in fact, it's probably too late to do anything about it.
Yep.
And we'll get into that a little bit later.
But let's get, you know, that was just a side thought. It just occurred to me. I think we should take a break right now. I'd like to remind our listeners, you're listening to Left Turn on Bird Street. We're heard every other Monday on KRBS in Orlando,
all the
California.
Time on the internet.
On the internet, right. You can also get our program, our past programs, by visiting our blog at www.ltobs.blogspot.com. And over on the right-hand side, there's an index of our previous programs. So we certainly encourage you to visit our blog. And we really encourage people to comment on our postings there. We post stories, our original stories from that Tom or myself compose, and then several links. And we have a fairly lively discussion board for each of our posts.
We've attracted as many loonies as we can.
Yeah, I know.
Alberto // in particular, but they don't, he doesn't add anything you'd want to agree with, but it's a good chuckle.
Yeah, for our people who are not familiar with our blog, if you go in there and you just click on some of the comments on our postings, every now and then you'll see a guy named Alberto.
//
Several slashes. And, you know, I've come to conclude that Alberto is like one of these workhorses, you know, in like an animal farm or a workhorse you see out in the field. They have blinders on, and then they put – you know, a blinder around their head, so they're just plowing forward while the other people are kind of sitting back, relaxing.
Well, you remember when Alberto first started to contribute, and I had the suspicion
spring,
that he
sometimes.
Was putting us on?
Yeah.
And I noticed that Wanda has come to the conclusion that I'm not sure this guy actually believes that stuff. I think he's putting us on, if you read that comment. So I'm not alone in thinking that this guy can't be real.
He can't. He could be a shill of some sort, but he is pretty funny. We do have some conservatives that come there, and these guys, as our good friend Wanda from the Potent Post Blogspot, or Words on a Page, she pointed out with a clever little thing with our conservative commenter Chris, who's been on this show actually. She says, Chris, you are in denial. He says, about Fox News. He says, is Cleopatra there with you? Anyhow, we're going to take a short musical break. You're listening to Left Turn on Bird Street, and we'll be back in just a minute.
Dad out.
Well, welcome back. You're listening to Left Turn on Bird Street. We're heard every other Monday on KRBS 107.1 FM in Oroville, California. And we're also heard on WCRV in Cherry Ridge, Pennsylvania. So thanks for joining us today. We certainly appreciate
CRV, you. Cash Rebate Value, or what's that?
Cash Redemption Value.
Oh, value, okay.
I think it's actually Carl Van Orden's, the general manager of that station. I think those are his initials, or CRV, Van Orden. CRV, right? Carl Van Orden. Should be really CVO, right? Carl Van Orden.
But often they just use the V.
Yeah, that's true. Right. Nice Dutch name, Van Orden, right? Mm-hmm. Anyhow, thanks for joining us today. Before our segment, we were talking about mostly about Katrina. We had our little segment on the history of rock and roll, which is, what, now 50 years old, Tom?
50 years old.
50 years old. And some people would contend it's on its last legs, or it's definitely gone into middle age now. But
well, I had my reaction to rock and roll when I first heard
this.
It was like, this will never last. Right. And I knew right off I was going to make a good investigative reporter.
It's just a passing fancy.
Give me that Glenn Miller any day.
Yeah, right. Glenn, how about Doris Day? She was kind of, you're old enough to remember when Doris Day was probably popular as a popular singer. Are you not? Or
right.
Was she ever popular?
I'm old enough to remember
singer?
As a popular movie star. But not as a popular singer. She had some songs.
Right. Right.
But she wasn't the. She was a big hit in the big band era of the 40s.
Oh.
And then she sort of elided into movies, and where she walked around with her bouffant haircut and whatever that was. And you see, my sister was a big Doris Day fan.
Oh, is that right?
You know, it didn't do much for me. But
right. Actually, you know, she the song she sang in, God, what was the Alfred Hitchcock movie?
Que sera.
No, that's the movie. That won an Oscar for the best song that year.
Did it?
Yes, it did, because I was watching that on AMC.
I thought she's done some other actually also popular songs that I can't remember because you just asked me.
Right.
Yeah, that's the big one. That's right up there with Frank Sinatra's song that was Mares Eat Oats and Does Eat Oats and Little Lambs Eat Ivy. Tuneless.
How did we get on the topic of Doris Day anyhow?
Age.
Age. Right. Well, in any case, we're going to continue our discussion about Hurricane Katrina, the aftermath, the government's lack of attention. And you know what? I think a lot of people look at it as a lack of attention. Tom and I have looked at this from a couple different angles. Excuse me. First of all, my initial take on this was, and I did a special broadcast of Left Turn on Bird Street on September 2nd about this. I actually feel strongly, and this is where race and class comes into play in the world of George W. Bush. I actually think they, on a certain level, if this disaster had happened in, say, the River Oaks section of Houston, which is where the Bush family resided for several years, or in some place like Grosse Pointe, Michigan, or the Hamptons in New York, or Beverly Hills, some sort of high-income white neighborhood, white section of a particular metropolitan area, I think emergency services would have been there lickety-split. The fact that most of the people that were left behind, and using the term of evangelicals here, who were left behind in New Orleans were predominantly poor African-American people. And it was pretty evident by viewing the film on television and hearing interviews on the radio. And I think on a certain level that the Bush administration, for the fact that these were poor people, and they could have easily been poor white people too, I guess, on a certain level, but the fact that they were poor African-American people, I believe really...
Dispensable.
They're dispensable. In the world of George W. Bush and the neocons, these are dispensable people, and there was no urgency. That was the first thing that kind of came across my... my mind. And as you talk to people, I think a lot of people actually share that same sentiment. Tom, on the other hand, had a little bit different take on it. And actually, Tom, you want to talk about how you feel the government is using this as kind of a dry run, a drill, if you
an
will.
Opportunity.
An opportunity.
That they can exploit.
Right.
To introduce military forces in the United States, having the U.S. Army policing the people. I want to go into all these things, but there have been many indications that police forces themselves have been moving towards it with some encouragement from the governments. And they've been looking for some excuse to introduce police force, army and navy and whatever, Coast Guard, which Coast Guard is really more of a police agency anyway.
Right.
Already, but and that's a good one. But it's going to be an opportunity to ratchet down on freedoms in the United States.
Right. You know, there was a story, I believe, on the a site on the internet. I believe it's called Army Times. And actually, it was interviewed in the Army Times. If I'm not mistaken, is a paper for the Armed Forces.
It is. At one time, it was sort of the Army paper. Now there's a. I used to have a girlfriend, who was one of the editors of Army Times. Then they merged the Army, Navy, and Air Force Times into one. So they're out of Northern Virginia, and they publish their. Privatized now, but essentially they're the mouthpiece for the military. This is the military's official newspaper.
Right. And anyhow, there was a story on the internet on the Army Times website interviewing soldiers going in there, and they're basically the tone of the story, and I unfortunately can't reference it right at this moment. Tom sent me the story. He emailed me the link, actually, where there was almost a gleeful proclamation by these soldiers, we're armed and ready to shoot, basically, was the whole tone of the story.
And they weren't going in to save people or police domestically. They were referring to the people in Louisiana as insurgents.
Right, insurgents. And this brings up a whole nother, well, we'll maybe get to that later, about some of the use of the words, specifically first couple days after the disaster, the major mainstream media were calling the people from New Orleans refugees. You know, they are called refugees.
And we can exclude them as we do, say, Cubans or Haitians.
Exactly. Like, they don't belong to us. But you know, I've really thought about this since Tom kind of shined the light on this for me, is this has really presented an opportunity for the Bush administration to exercise martial law and how it might be applied further on down the road here in the good old U.S. of A.
Well, you know, the this leads us to articles out of the British papers. Other papers see us slightly differently than we see ourselves.
Yes.
And in an article from World Socialist website, nobody likes that because there's a socialist in it, but it's actually a very good site, and it's
well written.
It's well written and a little long sometimes. But this is an article by Julie Hyland, ran 9 September 2005, and she addresses the question: the British media fears political consequences of Katrina. And her lead is, the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina has shocked even the most seasoned of British reporters. The sight of masses left without food, water, and adequate shelter, of bloated corpses lying uncollected in the putrid waters, whilst soldiers and police concerned only with protecting private property are ordered to shoot to kill anyone deemed to be obstructing their efforts, has met with genuine expressions of outrage and sometimes of disbelief that this could be happening in the wealthiest country in the world. But if there are disgust at the appalling conditions faced by millions in the U.S. South is tangible, so are their grave misgivings as to the social and political consequences of the crisis, not only for President George W. Bush, but for the entire U.S. ruling elite. Goes on, we'll skip down a little bit. In its September 4th lead, headlined, "The Week Bush Failed America," the Observer, an English paper of some note, wrote, "The conclusion that there has been a monumental failure of leadership is unavoidable, so that the humanitarian disaster of Katrina is also a political crisis for the president." And then skipping down further on, she quotes some of the individual stories by British reporters who either cover this Washington, D.C. and U.S. government or are roving reporters around the United States. Guardian, that's the Guardian UK,
right,
in Manchester.
Excellent newspaper, by the way.
Guardian journalist Gary Young in Baton Rouge, also known as Baton Rouge.
Baton Rouge.
Described how instead of help from FEMA, as he's referring to it, rumors of rape and murder in the New Orleans Superdome were being allowed to circulate unchecked. Police had been unable to confirm that any such incidents had taken place. And while many claim they happened, no witnesses, survivors, or survivors' relatives have come forward. Media demonizing of the stranded had led to reports in Baton Rouge that evacuees from New Orleans were carjacking and that guns and knives were being seized in local shelters where riots were erupting. The trouble, wrote Howard Witt of the Chicago Tribune, is that scarcely any of it was true. The police confiscated a single knife from one refugee in one Baton Rouge shelter. There were no riots in Baton Rouge. There were no armed hordes. He goes, I say, finally, almost the final, we got a couple more. The Independent, another good English newspaper,
yep,
British newspaper, lead article September 5th stated, we could be witnessing a significant moment in America. Hurricane Katrina has revealed some uncomfortable truths about the world's richest and most powerful nation. The catastrophe in New Orleans exposed shocking inequalities, both of wealth and race, and also the relative impotence of the federal authorities when faced with a large-scale disaster. Many Americans are beginning to ask just what sort of country they are living in. In the Times of London, it goes on, a Murdoch newspaper on the political right, Andrew Sullivan, another right-wing writer that's also published in the United States, observed, in the past, American disasters have led to political changes. To Johnstown flood in 1889 and the Galveston hurricane in 1900 led to fury at class privilege and government that seemed not to care for the poor. The 1927 flood in New Orleans and the inequalities it exposed propelled the rise of the populist demagogue Huey Long. There seems to be a strong chance that this calamity could be the beginning of something profound in American politics, a sense that government is broken and that someone needs to fix it. And I'm going to skip way down here. There has been, to another quote from the Daily Mail, there has been no shortage of warnings. People said, Bush said, we didn't know this was coming.
Yeah. Right.
4 years ago, before 9/11, the president was told, not could have read, but didn't, but was told,
right,
that the three biggest potential disasters facing the United States were a terrorist attack on New York, happened, a major earthquake in San Francisco, didn't happen,
right,
and a hurricane hitting New Orleans. Now, my question is, since they've been right so far, is San Francisco next?
Yeah, maybe.
That would be us.
Yeah, that would be us. You're right.
Essentially, because if San Francisco goes, that will open up the controlling levees again,
right,
into the levees. Valley.
Yep.
And that would, and you know, we're only 65 feet above sea level
right
here.
Right.
And
Tom, you live in Marysville, and in Marysville, California, that is, which is just south of Oroville. Marysville was hit hard. When was it, 97, with the Linda floods, or was Marysville
times,
fairly protected,
right,
fairly well protected?
Well, the city itself, not. But the Marysville itself is surrounded by levees. And so it's been well protected, although they're deteriorating these days too, we're told in newspaper reports. But levees in the same area, mm-hmm, have broken, but on the,
right,
the Sutter County side, or on the Yuba County side, but
right,
south of town, people died, property destroyed, and it took,
right,
years to recover from it.
Right.
If it actually broke inside Marysville, there's only three ways out of town.
Right. Yeah, and
there's four ways, but you wouldn't get 10,000.
One would probably be underwater, though. Well, I guess you could get out across the bridge over the Yuba City.
Well, if the town went, there would be no way out. But
yeah.
But even when it was flooding, it would be really difficult to get out of. It would be more constricted than New Orleans was.
Right. But, you know, that just goes to show you that, you know, the Bush administration, and this goes back really 25 years, and we were talking about this a little bit earlier, in one of my earlier postings, there's a lot of accountability that go around. But Bush, ultimately has to assume all of it. But, you know, this isn't something that just started in the last 4 or 5 years since the Bush administration came into took office, stole the office, actually. And that's a whole other subject. But, you know, you got to go back at least 25 years. And there's a gentleman's name, Tom and I were discussing a few minutes ago. His name is Grover Norquist. And Grover Norquist is an inside Republican operative. He is in charge of one project called the K Street Project, among many things. That project intends to replace all lobbyists in Washington, D.C. with pro-business lobbyists. That's a whole other subject. But Grover Norquist, do you have that quote from him, Tom?
About 15 or 20 years ago. Yes, it is. This is from the next story I was going to give you, but the Republicans we're talking about here rode into office in a highly contested election, spouting a message determined to undermine the federal government in every way but defense, and after 9/11, one presumed homeland security. And this is the quote. One with Grover Norquist, they were determined to shrink Washington until it was, quote, small enough to drown in a bathtub. And I think it's really interesting he chose the word drown.
Drown in a bathtub. And that actually describes New Orleans, actually, because, you know, many descriptions of it are geographically, it is a bathtub because much of the city lies below sea level.
Well, this comes from a column by Gordon Adams. I'll read you more of it because it has some other interesting things to say.
Mm-hmm.
That quote I was giving from Grover Quist, Norquist. Katrina was, he's saying, the writer of the column, not Norquist, was saying, Katrina has stripped the veil from this mean-spirited strategy of drowning democracy in a bathtub, exposing the greed, mindlessness, and sheer profiteering behind it.
That's exactly right. And Grover Norquist, you know, we have to look back at the problems, not just in the Bush administration, they're ultimately the ones who are going to be held accountable
for. Well, they co-opted the Democrats.
Right. Yeah, you're right. But this goes back 25 years and more in some cases. You could actually probably trace it back to Nixon's time. 1964, the defeat of Barry Goldwater to Lyndon
Johnson. They decided we're
B.
taking
Johnson.
Over. And
right.
They started, they worked hard, and that's where they are.
They worked very hard. But, you know, the thing that is interesting about it for me is, I think now, and it goes like with what we referred to earlier with Trent Lott criticizing Michael Brown. I guarantee you if Trent Lott's home hadn't been touched or hadn't been in his home state where the voters might take their wrath out on him and other of the neocons, had he been from, say, Texas or Arkansas or, you know, any place other than Louisiana, Mississippi, or even Alabama.
Massachusetts,
yeah. You know, he wouldn't have given one rat's ass about the people there. He wouldn't care about Michael Brown. In fact, he'd probably be on Fox News defending him, as many of the other conservative talking heads are. But, you know, once something hits somebody, and I've used this term over and over again, the Cancer Society syndrome. You know, people don't join the Cancer Society until they or a loved one has
until
cancer. Until it's too late. And, you know, I think that's what's happening now. And hopefully this will be a wake-up call for Americans that if you want to have good schools for your kids, if you want to have well-maintained roads, if you want to have levees.
So you're talking about the gravy, Dan. What you're really talking about, so you want to stay out of jail and not confine your home and still be able to vote on something and get an outcome that you were hoping for, then you want to start thinking about it now.
Right.
Those are the schools and the roads and the smooth operation of the Wall Street. Those are all just the gravy parts.
Right. You're right. But if you want all of these things, you've got to pay taxes. And what the Bush and the neocons have done is they've redistributed wealth from the poor and middle class to the wealthy. And who are the ones in New Orleans that didn't have protection from the flood?
Now,
it's the poor.
Redistribute is the Chinese word for rob.
Steal.
Yeah. Steal, rob. Okay.
Right. I'm just being politically correct, I guess you could say. But yeah, they robbed the the money that would otherwise help middle class and lower middle class and poor people, and they give that in the form of tax breaks to the wealthiest Americans. And it's just a big scheme, if nothing else, just to really imprison American citizens in our own country. And they're doing it not necessarily by throwing us in jail, although many people are thrown in jail. They're doing it by house arrest and by economic means. And
limiting what you can find out from television. They're trying to regulate the internet. Radio's always been co-opted by...
Clear Channel, Viacom, and all the other huge corporate interests.
Getting back to the Gordon Adams story, this comes from the Baltimore Sun.
Yes.
And I don't believe he's syndicated. I think this was written especially for the Baltimore Sun. So you know that this is a relative expression of the Baltimore Sun editorial position. And the Baltimore Sun, I want to point out, is one of the top five newspapers in the United States. New York Times, LA Times, Washington Post, Baltimore Sun. And the Boston Globe, I think, is the other.
Yeah.
But anyway, he's saying that the disastrous federal response to Katrina exposes a record of incompetence, misjudgment, and ideological blinders that should lead to serious doubts that the Bush administration should be allowed to continue in office. He goes on, they're calling, time for Bush to go. This is the first time I've seen in print in a major newspaper calling for either the impeachment or the ouster in some way of Bush. Skipping down some paragraphs, he's done this when this happens, when that happens. He's just accumulating all the reasons that he should go. This is when, and this is these are a couple examples. When FEMA officials cannot figure out that there are thousands stranded at the New Orleans Convention Center, where people died and were starving, and fussed ineffectively about the same problems in the Superdome. They should be fired, not praised, as the president praised FEMA director Michael Brown in New Orleans last week. When Mr. Bush states publicly that nobody could anticipate a breach of the levee, while New Orleans journalists, Scientific American, National Geographic, academic researchers, and Louisiana politicians had been doing precisely that for decades, right up through last year. And even as Hurricane Katrina passed over, he should be laughed out of office as an imposter. Later on, it goes on to say, he, meaning Bush, betrays the unwillingness of this administration to speak truth and hold itself accountable. As in the case of the miserable execution of policy in Iraq, Mr. Bush and Karl Rove always have some excuse for failure other than their own misjudgments. We have a president who is apparently ill-informed, lackadaisical, and narrow-minded, surrounded by oil-bearing cronies, religious fundamentalist crazies, and right-wing extremists and ideologues. He has appointed officials who give incompetence new meaning, who replace the positive role of government with expensive baloney. And then it goes on to the Grover Norquist. Now, that's a pretty straightforward call for the resignation, impeachment, or disbarment. He's not a lawyer.
He's not a lawyer. But, just impeachment is really what it should be done.
How about disembowelment?
Well, this reminded me, you know, we're getting close to the end of our segment here, but Tom sent me a link about a week ago, and I lost the link, but I remembered it. I looked, I did a Google search on failure, the word failure. And out of about 2.5 million possibilities, what is the thing? The top search on that queue was the official White House page of George W. Bush. Now, how did that? I can see if somebody's writing about a miserable failure, but
no. But see, it just does the one word because the White House came up tops because it was saying, this is not a failure. Do not regard this as a failure. And so they said it so many times to counteract the other stuff. Right. So it's even worse.
Anyhow, you're listening to Left Turn on Bird Street here on KRBS 107.1 FM in Oroville, California. Thank you for joining us today. Stay tuned with us. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back with our second segment. You're listening to Left Turn on Bird Street.